Welcome back to the Off Top Podcast, otherwise known as the Brian Colangelo is a fucking idiot podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, I am so excited to begin this podcast. I'm also sick, so I'm going to try and limit the amount of yelling and or laughing I do. Lo, introduce yourself, man.
Yo, what up, podcast people? It's the one and only legend of winning, a.k.a. Lo. I low-key thought that we were only going to be able to talk about, like, the playoffs and kind of review the conference finals in both East and the Western Conference. But like you said, Brian Colangelo, my goodness, what an idiot.
I'm not even going to try and limit the cursing on this one. He's a fucking idiot. And oh my goodness. All right, Lo, I just came off a stream playing some Fortnite, and Lo graciously provided me with some information. Lo, explain to the people this whole Colangelo dilemma.
All right, so for people out there, we're recording this right now on the 29th or 30th, whatever, right? And news is just now getting out that Brian Colangelo, allegedly, but at this point, there's so much overwhelming amount of evidence that is in favor of Brian Colangelo is out here with multiple burner Twitter accounts going around criticizing not only the coaching staff for the 76ers, not only the players for the 76ers, but even old vendettas that he has against ex-associates such as Masai Ujiri with the Toronto Raptors.
Ujiri. And Ujiri. Also for the people who haven't been initiated, Brian Colangelo, he was a GM of the year with the Suns. The Raptors picked him up. He did a horrible job with the Raptors. He drafted Bargnani. Lo, you remember that? First overall. And then the 76ers picked him up and for whatever reason trusted him with all of their draft picks, which I knew was going to turn out in a disaster. But they didn't know that. And so this is probably the biggest scandal I've ever seen from Brian Colangelo. But the evidence is mounting hilariously. And it's in a very time. So the entire Ringer article, I'm going to let you go through it.
So I'm not going to restate everything that's in the Ringer article, but just a quick review. They gave up on Hinkie basically about a year and a half ago, and like Agent said, that's when they brought in Brian Colangelo. So, just as a quick review, and this is like the opening of the article, in February, the Ringer received an anonymous tip that Brian Colangelo, the Philadelphia 76ers president of basketball operations, which is basically the GM, has been secretly operating 5 Twitter accounts. Since then, there's been an internal investigation within the Philadelphia 76ers, and then today it's gotten out. But the overcasting of it is criticizing players, and when he's criticizing players, such as Joel Embiid, about how he doesn't take things serious and how he dances in the hallway and how he's eating unhealthy off the court and how he doesn't stay in tip-top shape. Jahlil Okafor forcing the media, like media members, to question Jahlil Okafor about him passing physicals so they can like try to trade him so it doesn't become harder for them to trade him. And Nerlens Noel about his commitment to the organization and him actually trying that hard. He furthermore criticized Sam Hinkie, and like we said earlier, Masai. He questioned Sam Hinkie because he felt like Sam Hinkie wasn't really doing enough, and he just lucked up in some of the players that he received and the opportunity he received during the draft. He also questioned Masai, claiming that Masai really didn't do nothing for the organization because everything that Masai was able to do was really just carrying over for what Brian Colangelo did, which, like Agent said, he drafted Bargnani with the number one pick, and Masai is the one who had to go out of his way.
Like,
okay, I'll read.
And say which burner account it was with, which one of the 5 it was with.
All right, hold on. Here's one of the Jahlil ones. Or at least I think it is. Okay. So, Sixers Nation, which hit one of his accounts is called Eric Jr. at Al Vic in a whole bunch of random numbers. They're ridiculous burner accounts. But Sixers Nation is another Twitter account that's like a, I don't want to say verified, but it's like a news outlet for the Philadelphia 76ers. And the question that they were asking on February 15, 2017 was, do you think that this Okafor situation is helping to make Nerlens want to stay here once his contract is up? I don't know how to feel. So Eric Jr., quote unquote, Brian Colangelo, he responds with yes, because he knows the team is protecting Jahlil, not saying why they're going to deal for him. Noel behaving like a vulture to get more money.
Jeez.
That's how deep this is. Not only that, there's other tweets where he's going around basically just straight out admitting that Jahlil Okafor, the reason why they don't want to deal with him, and the reason why it's hard to get rid of him is because he's not passing physicals or things of that nature. Also, here's another one that, again, this is allegedly, and he's responding to the exact same Sixers Nation tweet. Noel is looking out for Noel. Nobody knows about Jahlil's knee, and he's using it for leverage. What's a great teammate? He's disgusting me. To that degree. So it's not like some little critiques here and there. We're going as far as saying disgusting, they're vultures, they're selfish. Again, this is the general manager for the Philadelphia 76ers.
So there's a Twitter page called Liberty Ballers. I've seen them a few times. They put out this article criticizing Brian Colangelo. Somebody replied to that and said, he's going to ruin everything Hinkie built. And Brian Colangelo responded on one of his burner accounts saying, clown? Why? What did Hinkie build? My gosh, the biased insanity. Like, he's really speaking his mind on these accounts where he felt like he couldn't be held responsible for what he's saying. And it is absolutely hilarious now that we're finding out. And you said that he was unfollowing a bunch of people to try and make it look like it wasn't him as soon as the story got out?
Yes. Yeah, so like we said before, like I said earlier, the story has been internal for the last few months. Like they said, in February is when the Ringer received an actual tip. But it's been going on internally with the 76ers as early as I've read as January. So once it was brought up to his attention, obviously he's going to deny it. However, what ended up happening is that he has, if I'm not mistaken, 5 multiple burner accounts. one of the burner accounts is following personal people that only Brian Colangelo would associate himself with. So, for example, since I contacted, this is a quote from the Ringer's post. Since I contacted the 76ers, Steel Balling, which is one of Brian Colangelo's burner accounts, Steel Balling has unfollowed 37 accounts with direct ties to Colangelo, including several of his son's college basketball teammates, a former coach from his son's high school, and an accountant that shares the same agent as Brian Colangelo. And also someone who used to previously represent Colangelo as well. Like, those are so directly connected to Brian Colangelo that it's not even coincidental. It's so obviously that it's Brian Colangelo. The fact that he would immediately unfollow these people at the exact same time is ridiculous. But that's what Brian Colangelo is doing. Here's somebody else, though. Shout out to Adam at Sixers Adam. He's saying that on Twitter, sorry, Brian, I got you. Went to reset the passwords because Brian Colangelo has been attempting to get rid of the accounts, and someone else is basically trying to hack him and reset the passwords. Damn. He said, I went to reset the passwords, and 3 of the 5 burner accounts, every single one has a phone number ending in 9-1. This is clearly not a coincidence. And he also noted that he kind of cropped out Colangelo's emails out of the picture. Basically, what I'm saying is the evidence is so overwhelmingly mounting against Brian Colangelo that it's obviously that it's Colangelo who's doing it. It's not anybody else, because no one would have all that information against all of the teammates, the information against Masai and Sam Hinkie critiquing all these people, while also having ties directly to Brian Colangelo as well, such as his son's teammates in college. Like, that's how ridiculous this is.
So the real question is, why? What is a reasonable explanation for criticizing your own players? Because you know how that's going to look. And B already put out a bunch of tweets He replied to Woj. Woj put out a tweet saying,
"Oh wait, I'm sorry. I have to cut you off real quick. A huge reason why this kind of got caught out because once everything was rolling, this man Embiid took it to a whole nother level of savagery. Was on Twitter liking the tweets from Brian Colangelo's burner account, and that's when Twitter really started to pick up on it because he was directly liking tweets from random burner accounts that no one didn't know about until now. That's what really kind of pushed it over the edge.
Yeah, so he said in a statement that he trusts Colangelo till now, and Colangelo, of course, is denying all of this, but it's so very clear that he's the one, allegedly, of course, that's behind all of this. And Embiid put out a tweet saying, "I'm upset," and he at Drake. So he's definitely feeling some sort of way. And Embiid's, every single time he's feeling, he's pretty clear about his emotions on Twitter. Like when the Celtics got eliminated, he put out a tweet and said, "I guess they're on the couch too now." Because every time Embiid would criticize somebody in the playoffs, everyone would say, "But you're sitting on your couch." And now he's like, so I'm just trying to say that Embiid always speaks his mind. So I know in his statement, he did say that for now, until the evidence, but we know. And you know how it's going to look for the team. The general manager is out there criticizing players, saying Embiid doesn't take things seriously enough. That's not a good look at all. And I try to tell the 76ers, man, that Brian Colangelo was a horrible general manager for the Raptors. And he spent so much time doing nothing. When he was the general manager for the team was just running on the spot over and over and over again, making no improvements at all. Of course, Bargnani was one of the biggest flops in draft history, only to be outdone by probably Anthony Bennett, right? And so when the 76ers is a team with an insane amount of high-quality draft picks, picked the guy that drafted Bargnani first overall and fucked up the Raptors, I thought to myself, why would they possibly do that? Are they not looking at the evidence over the course of the last 6-7 years he was with the Raptors? Or do they just not care? So they fired Hinkie, you know, and they decided to go with Colangelo. And I knew it wasn't going to end well, right? Nerlens Noel left. They didn't really get much back. Jahlil Okafor, and they drafted Markelle Fultz, and he didn't play in the first year. But because Embiid and Ben Simmons were panning out, and those are obvious picks, like, it kind of just, nobody was really criticizing Colangelo because everything was forming. You know, the whole plan was kind of just coming together. Of course, most of the credit going to Sam Hinkie. So we're in a weird position now where Brian Colangelo has managed to turn the entire team against him. Because how could you possibly trust the guy at the top of your organization when he's been behind your back talking smack? He didn't post it on his own Twitter page. He made 5 burner accounts. And Lo, you said how long was the investigation was going on for how long?
The internal, whatever, there were talks about it for a while, but they made it into internal investigation in January. So, and obviously, I mean, they gotta get enough evidence to like kind of
5 months. Where we are you tell right me now. For 5 months, if they're still investigating something, that means there's some shit behind it. So this is the.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna sit here and lie to you. I mean, at first I thought it was kind of like, you know, obviously Twitter kind of gets a little crazy, yeah. But there's at this point the amount of evidence that's behind it, and it's not just people on Twitter tweeting about it. It's like credible people, like even Woj is tweeting about it right now, and like it's credible people who are talking about it, who are still holding some level of I guess it's just credit in favor of this man, Brian Colangelo, and not trying to, you know, completely out him or not to completely throw him under the bus since they don't have overwhelming evidence yet, even though I believe they do. But all right. I believe they do, but obviously you got to keep a level of professionalism. But when Woj and Sham and you got all these verified people who are like, oh man, this if this is true, which it definitely seems like it's true, like this is a really bad thing. And the only reason why to me this is a huge problem is for two reasons. One, part of building the process and part of having a dynasty or whatever you want to say is also being in tip-top shape, not just with the players on the floor, but also the decision makers in the front office. And I think that is a problem that many people fail to realize, that talent will only get you so far, and you're going to have to fill out the rosters, make the hard decisions when it comes to bringing the personnel and the players. And I don't necessarily know if Sam Hinkie was that person, but Brian Colangelo has provided enough evidence that, quite honestly, he doesn't have the greatest of track records doing so, right? And so, if the argument is we got to trust the process, and it's this building process with the 76ers, but the person who was supposed to be bringing in the pieces year in and year out and making the tough decisions financially and so on and so forth, if he's Brian Colangelo, and you have players who don't trust him, and you have coaching staffs, like, he was criticizing everybody. And so when everyone is against the general manager, it makes it that much harder for him to do his job accordingly, which people are already questioning his competency in his own job. The second part of this, though, is, and I'm not necessarily saying that they were going to get LeBron, but there's no way that LeBron is leaving a dysfunctional organization with a ridiculous owner who's trying to be a general manager in Cleveland to go join the Philadelphia 76ers with clown-ass Brian Colangelo. He's not doing that.
The most frustrating thing for me is his criticism of Embiid not taking things seriously. Like, I think it's really entertaining that Embiid will get a massage on the court before the game, or he'll be eating a burger in Hassan Whiteside's face, almost like mocking him, like he's not even worried that Hassan Whiteside is going to get the better of him on that game. The fact that, for whatever reason, the general managers or even fans sometimes think it's okay to just crush the happiness of these players. Do you remember, Lowe, when Dwight Howard went to the Lakers? He was smiling, and the team was fumbling and doing really bad throughout the season. And the media was criticizing him like crazy, saying he's not taking things seriously, mostly because he was just smiling and having fun while he was playing. Why are we criticizing these players for smiling, for enjoying what they do? This is what they do for a living. You don't think they enjoy it? So, I mean, I love the antics. I love how ridiculous Embiid is. He's easily the most entertaining player for me to watch. And I hate that the general manager of his team thinks that. And it's one thing to say that he's not eating healthy or whatever, whatever, whatever. And he probably knows more than us what Embiid is eating or what his nutrition is looking like. But don't try and stomp the happiness out the guy. What is wrong with you? I mean, I can't stand people like that. Let these players enjoy themselves. Let them smile. I get it. Everybody wants to win a championship. And for general managers and for the people in the front office, they all just want to make some money. But damn, man, that's your franchise player right there. Hey.
So again, just in case people don't necessarily know the details in which we're referring to or which I'm referring to. Again, this is all in the Ringer article, and they're quoting him from the Twitter accounts. One of the Twitter accounts said this to responding to someone else about the situation with Joel Embiid because he missed a few games during the regular season. This is verbatim what the Twitter account says. Joel, you're just a kid, but why didn't you tell the docs your knees hurt before Houston? You cost yourself, in quotation marks, us, 9+ games and a playoff spot. Like, how specific that is ridiculous. That is so...
That has to be somebody in the organization. Specific. That's not just a fan.
That's what I'm saying. How would you know that? Here's another one. This is one where he's criticizing Joel Embiid for dancing. Too bad that Embiid dances like a fool and the whole disaster happened. Next time, he will think twice before mocking his team.
So how does him dancing, what does that have to do with
this?
You know the no correlation gif? You know the one I'm talking about? With the graph and the dots are all over the place.
It's just ridiculous.
That is insane. So Brian Colangelo, man.
It's just more things about how, like, certain beat writers should be called out or certain coaches should be called out. It's extensive. Like, it's really extensive.
So, Woj tweeted that the GMs believe Colangelo because they can't think of a reasonable explanation why somebody would risk their job to put out tweets like that on a burner account. Where if you could just tell by the information that somebody high up had that info. Now, whether he dispersed that info to somebody else is one thing. But it came from somewhere, from someone who knows and is kept in the loop all the time with that organization. That's just weird. Why would... Anyway, Lo, I don't want to talk more about this. I just want the 76ers to know that I feel sorry for y'all, man. If you guys get a chance, just take a look at the draft picks and the trades that Colangelo did with the Raptors. He is a horrible general manager. And he is the worst person to be in the position he's in. The fact that he's even in that position getting any sort of credit for what Hinkie built in that organization is absolutely pathetic. And I hope this is proved correct. Even if it's not, Lo, I am assured that Brian Colangelo will find another way to ruin the 76ers. No doubt about that. And it seems like based on Embiid's tweets, he's came around to believing that indeed Brian Colangelo is the one behind those accounts. So we'll leave it on that note. Lo, let's talk about...
Oh, well, let me say this last thing. Brian Colangelo, man, get your shit together. Because, like, you... Even beyond, like, the whole, like, putting your team in jeopardy... Bro, how old are you? What do you do that your life isn't busy enough as a general manager for an organization that quite honestly was pulling off a lot of transactions throughout the entire preseason and offseason in this upcoming year, that you found a time to create 5 burner accounts and was reacting to not just verify people, to like miscellaneous people across Twitter, to the point where I honestly believe you might have been going out of your way to search up certain highlighted words about somebody else. And going as far as certain people criticizing like even other prospects, because people were criticizing how he took Fultz and it seems like it's not working out. And so then he's going around saying that, well, the Sixers weren't, allegedly, is his burner account saying, well, the Sixers were not supposed to take, the Sixers weren't going to take Tatum because he wasn't a good fit. And Lonzo, he doesn't look that good either. So from my estimation, the 76ers did a fine opportunity, something along the lines that they did a good in the, draft. Like, you're 52 years old. What are you doing? What are you doing?
What a shame. What a shame. And this is the moment where I say, and I quote, I told you so. I seen it coming. From a mile away, from 10 miles away, I knew a day like this would come where Colangelo would find a way to either draft the Bargnani for the 76ers or just fuck it up in one way, some way, and he managed, man. It's fantastic. So, let's talk about...
Wait, before we go... Dude, they have to fire him, right?
If it's true, absolutely. I mean, there's no other options.
They have to fire him. Like it's not even like a kind of sort of thing. Like that is a we have to fire you, not necessarily because you may not be doing your job or bringing in the right talent. We have to fire you because people who are working under you don't trust you.
Yeah, the second you lose that trust, it's over. And
he lost the
trust of all of the relevant players on the 76ers. Even if he wasn't actively tweeting about them, if my name is Simmons and I see that he's criticizing Embiid for dancing like a fool when he's never ever brought up something like that to Embiid, or he's never even nudged Embiid to, hey, maybe you should be a little bit healthier, is crazy. That's how you lose trust. And in the NBA, especially in the front office, man, it's all about trust. I think that's part of the reason why Masai Ujiri is such a fantastic general manager, though. Anyway, besides the point. Jesus Christ. All right, which series do you want to talk about, Lo? The Golden State Warriors versus the Rockets, or do you want to talk about the Cavaliers versus the Celtics?
Let's do the Cavs, right, man.
Cavaliers found a way. I'm happy to say my prediction was right. Cavs in 7. Although it would have been exciting, of course, to see the Celtics move on to the finals. And just to see something different for once. I'm trying to figure out what it is about the Cavaliers where they just find a way to win all the time. Even when it doesn't look like they have a chance at winning, they just find a way to win. LeBron has been playing out of his mind in the playoffs, and he'll kick it in the corner and players are just missing. And Lo, I'm kind of coming around to the narrative all of a sudden, ever since the Celtics series, that LeBron might be carrying. Now, previously, I was under the impression that...
It's taking you this long?
No, but here's the thing, Lo, is I always thought that it's LeBron's team. He's the leader. And he has competent players who've played great on other teams in the past, right? And so why is it that when they all go on LeBron's team, everybody's playing poorly? There has to be something up with that. But, man, when I watch these guys play sometimes, I just think to myself, Jesus, man, LeBron just has to do everything by himself. And, oh, man, it is an incredibly impressive series. Shout out to the Celtics. They managed to get it to 7 games without Kyrie or Hayward. What's your biggest takeaway from the series, Lo?
My biggest takeaway is that the it was a few things, but I think my biggest takeaway is that out of the talks that many people in the NBA community have been having about the next upcoming team or which team has the brightest future, to me it's very obvious that it would have to be the Boston Celtics. For you to go 7 games in the conference finals without your two best players, when quite frankly, I would argue even if just Kyrie was there, you would be fine. It's vastly impressive. And then you also keep in mind that they have other assets, because they have a Sacramento Kings pick next year, along with a Memphis pick, or potentially a Memphis and a Clippers pick next year as well. So it's just vastly impressive to see what this organization has done and how they've been able to bounce back and rebuild and where they are right now compared to some of their competitors, I guess, or who are in the rebuilding phase, and how quickly they've been able to bounce back and have the type of success that they had while being led by Al Horford, the great Al Horford, the great Al Horford. But also, you know, Jason Tatum, as a rookie, performing the way that he performed, I would argue that there's players who've been in the NBA for 10 plus years who we give all-star selections to and even try to put in conversation on all NBA teams who don't perform as well as Jason Tatum has played throughout the entire postseason run, let alone how he showed up in Game 7 against LeBron. So that's my biggest takeaway. Second biggest takeaway is, if Kyrie was healthy, they would not have won. And on the flip side of things, if Kyrie had stayed with the Cavs probably would have swept through the playoffs again. And if not swept through, they probably would have lost no more than 3 games in total throughout all 3 rounds.
So what do you think about Terry Rozier? He was playing well throughout the majority of the playoffs, but in that Game 7, man, I ain't never seen a performance that brutally awful. He was just chucking up.
Oh no! You saw one. It was Game 7 against the Houston Rockets.
Right.
At that moment, that was the worst one, right? And then the next day, we saw even one worse. That was even worse. Yeah. Yeah, we saw even worse. But yeah, I mean, to me, and the reason why, again, it's so impressive for Jason Tatum to do what he did is because, again, you're a rookie and you're not expected to show up like that. Because in a Game 7,
rookie. He hasn't really been getting. This is the first time he's ever got heavy minutes. That's only because.
But that's what I'm saying. I expected Rozier to be inconsistent deeper into the playoff runs, and even in this round, he didn't really perform that well against the Cavs. And as a series progressed, he was getting worse. And so I'm not going to sit here and say I predicted that he was going to shoot, you know, 0-for-10 from behind the arc. But it doesn't surprise me that he underperformed significantly, because if you look at what exactly was happening throughout the entire series, along during the postseason, he was vastly inefficient and inconsistent through multiple games. It's just that when they needed him the most, it never really happened. And I guess we may have taken it for granted for young players such as, again,
isn't like part of it just Tatum like stopping? Like, at a certain point, don't you just like for example, though, when I'm at the rec, man, and I miss a bunch of shots, and whatever reason I'm not feeling my jumper today, and they're sagging on me because they're betting on me to shoot because that's gonna be a low percentage shot. He's not feeling it. Like, why would he continue to shoot? So he had one good game from the 3-point line against the Cavaliers where he shot 6-for-10, and that was Game 6, and they were getting destroyed that game anyway. The other games against the Cavaliers are, and I cannot make this stuff up, 0-for-3, 2-for-8, 1-for-4, 3-for-9, 1-for-7, and 0-for-10. So throughout that entire series, it felt like the three-point shot that was on point against the 76ers kind of just dissipated, man. And although we saw some players on the Celtics continue to shoot at least decent or on pace with what they've been doing, it's like we were almost relying at that point on players like Horford to step up offensively just for the Celtics to get a win. And the Cavaliers, though, aren't a good defensive team. The Celtics have been just running through folks offensively throughout the playoffs. I did not think they were going to struggle against the Cavalier team. But I guess it wasn't even a matter of good or bad defense. It was just they weren't hitting shots. And it almost seemed like, you know, before the game 7, Marcus Smart was like, you got to be ready to bleed. You got to be ready to fight. And they just didn't really come with that fight. But my biggest takeaway probably is Marcus Smart himself, man. I don't know what I seen, but he impressed me. And I've never been this impressed with a player who is coming off injuries all the time and is previously known pretty popularly for being a flopper in the NBA, playing like grade A defense, like he belongs on an all NBA defensive team. And on top of that, offensively, still finding ways to contribute. It was impressive, man. Altogether, like, I think Marcus Smart would be great behind Kyrie. I think if they can, they need to find a way to move Terry. I don't even know if when Kyrie's back, he'll have a spot on the rotation that's worth any more than 20 minutes per game. But we'll see. I don't know if they're going to wean Kyrie back into the lineup and he might get some more minutes early on in the season. I guess that's what the preseason is for anyway. But shout out to the Celtics.
Let me answer two questions, though. When it comes to Terry Rozier, and this is where knowing your role kind of kicks in, Terry Rozier straight up said that they interviewed him. I don't know if it was his exit interview or they were just interviewing him. But he interviewed him. They were interviewing him, and they asked him about Kyrie and how he felt about Kyrie. And he flat out said, I'm not really concerned about Kyrie because I know he's going to come back and be our starter. Like, he's going to be fine. And so even though many people may view that as not really an indictment, but just, and I don't even really think it's sacrificing, because in my opinion, the idea that anybody thought that they should have traded Kyrie because Terry Rozier was going to be the starting point guard was silly. And that is something else that pissed me off through the entire postseason, how people were questioning the value of Kyrie with the logic, the flawed logic that people were utilizing to make that argument.
Not gonna lie, man, I haven't seen that but, one time.
Oh, it's people all on my timeline who did that. But even with the Terry Rozier thing, he knows for a fact that he's a bench player, which is fine and that's great. On the flip side, though, we have Marcus Smart, where I've read certain things and I don't necessarily know if they're true or not, but he is due to get paid, and I've seen quotes claiming that he's throwing up amounts such as $13 million a year. And so,
if I was the Raptors, I'd take him for $13 million a year. That's a good price.
Well, the thing is, I don't necessarily know how much they have in their budget to give him $13 million, which is a huge reason why I think they have to look at trading away Gordon Hayward, as crazy as it sounds. Because if you already found your option with your starting forwards or starting perimeter players,
I think
Brown,
when you have Kyrie back and Gordon Hayward, man, that offense is going to be moving so nice with incredibly fluid off-ball screens, and I don't think...
But I'll even go as far as saying this, and this is not really a knock on Gordon Hayward, but what is it that Tatum did this year that you think that he's not going to be able to duplicate next year?
He's just not as good a scorer. He might be, eventually.
I disagree.
You think Tatum is a better scorer than Hayward, though? You're bugging right now, my guy.
I don't think I'm bugging. I think it's, and even if you want to say he's better, it's not like the gap is so big that you can't expect the type of development from Tatum next year. Furthermore, in that game 7, I don't think I would have gotten that type of productivity from Gordon Hayward. I just don't.
I disagree with you wholeheartedly. In his last year with Utah, the guy was shooting 47% from the field, getting 22 points per game. In what we could both agree is not a great offense. Like, Utah is a great defensive team, and they get a lot of.
I don't know, but they okay.
You see what I'm going at?
Utah wasn't a. that they weren't, they were closer to a great offense than a bad offense. And there was definitely a system that they were utilizing to allow Hayward to score. And I'm not knocking Hayward as a scorer, but you're saying 47% from the field. Tatum shot 47% from the field this year.
Yeah, but he was the main scorer, is what I'm trying to say, man. Like,
but Hayward isn't going to be the main scorer on the Celtics. And quite frankly, there really isn't that much of a main scorer. But if we were to label somebody as a main scorer, it would be
Kyrie. No, I get that. What I'm saying is, when he was on the Jazz, he was the main scorer, still on double teams, able to put up buckets like he did at an efficient rate. And so Jason Tatum has never had the pressure of being the main scorer. He's always had magnets on his team.
This playoff run, I don't know what you...
Come on, man. You think he was a main scorer in this playoff run? Don't kid yourself, Lo.
So who was scoring more points than Jason Tatum?
I think Jaylen Brown was balling for sure. I don't know if we would put Horford in the mix, because has had some games where he was just shooting like a bucket and it wasn't really working for him. But Jaylen Brown was easily, like, I would say, the top scorer in the playoffs for that team.
Well, let me tell you, he wasn't. It was Tatum. Tatum is the one who scored more points than anybody else.
What are you
in
talking
that team
about? Points per game in the playoffs?
I'm talking about the entire playoffs.
Points per game?
Yes, nigga. I guess. What are you saying?
Because Jaylen Brown didn't play a game, so I'm just saying, if you're doing total points.
Jaylen Brown 18 points, Tatum 18.5. But Tatum shot better from beyond.
Yeah, Tatum shot better from the field. Impressive 3-point shooter off rip. that challenge of coming off of the college 3-point line and then taking it, I believe it's a foot back on the 3-point in the NBA. Lo, I don't know if you ever got a chance to step on an NBA court. Yo, it is really far. You know, you don't think 1 foot is a big enough difference to throw someone off, but it is. So to come in off rip, I mean, it's impressive. I mean, you'll have to convince me, Lo, but I do think, as of right now, Jaylen Brown is a better scorer. Whether, you know, Jason Tatum has more length and he'll be able to do this and this in his career and in the future, you know, a lot of people are comparing him to Giannis.
That's a different story. I think he has more moves in his arsenal than Brown does as well. But what I'm saying is, with the development of Tatum as well next season, because everything that Tatum just accomplished, he was 19, 20 years old. So with the development of what Tatum may be able to bring,
I'm tired of people reminding me how old he was, man.
Oh my God! With the development of what Tatum is what we're really expecting him to bring you on the floor. If you're saying that Hayward, in that lineup with Kyrie in that system as well, is going to give you 17 at most 20 points.
Wow, I'm looking at his playoff numbers. He was consistently good. Jaylen Brown was all over the place. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, he was. Wow.
So that's what I'm saying. So if you're telling me that Tatum is going to be, if you're telling me that Hayward next year is going to give you somewhere between 17 to 20 points on, let's just say, 47.
Yeah, you might be right about
38.
That. You got to think about too low. He's off, coming off injury. Like, not a lot of teams are going to want to take a risk on a player.
I agree with that, but if the opportunity is there, I don't know why you wouldn't take it. That's
yeah, they have
saying.
Enough depth. I mean, what would they trade him away for, though? I can't think of a play. Like, you're going to have Al Horford at center. Kyrie's coming back. Is Morris still going to be on the lineup next year? I'm not sure if he has an expiring.
Morris is going to be on the lineup, but I think they do need just more. I think they need depth, but if they can get an upgrade at in the front court, then I would take it. I mean, not really the front court at the five, really. Because as much as I... As
you mean
much
like
as
in place of Al Greg Horford, Monroe?
In place of, what's his man, Aaron Baines, because it was amazing to me how many minutes Aaron Baines.
I mean, I don't know how he's, defensively,
stop.
He did what he had. Offensively, he wasn't really doing much, but he almost reminds me of I'm trying to think of a player. Nah, you're right, I was going to say Aaron Gray. Like, he's not really a shot blocker, he's like a hustle player. He reminds me of maybe Biyombo.
Stop. He did what he was supposed to do, but if we're being realistic here, we were lowering the bar for him because no one really expected much out of him, and so, and even when it came to the
Aaron Baines is gone,
the Cavs,
next year. So is Greg Monroe. So you're right; they will have space for.
They need, and when it came to the Cavs, they were just picking Aaron Baines apart through pick and roll and forcing him as far as out of the paint as he possibly could. So all I'm saying is, if they can get upgraded in that position, regardless of what they need to do, I feel like that would be the perfect move they need to do. I mean, realistically speaking, I'm not necessarily saying that this is going to happen, but just realistically speaking,
Sorry. They could do a sign and trade. Gordon Hayward's getting paid $31 million, my guy. Nobody's taking that. Coming off of injury, zero people are taking that. I can't think of a team who would take that.
I don't know.
Actually, the Raptors, if they'll take DeRozan, but I mean, nobody would take, you know? So
no one's taking
DeRozan. If they want a useful player back, like, they're going to have to offer a pick or something with that. And I don't know if they're willing to sacrifice that. And it might be time at a certain point. Like, what are you going to do with all these young players? Yo, the Celtics can low in like 3 years have the most paid team in NBA history. Because if everybody's a restricted free agent, they could just max everybody and keep everybody on roster. And because players like Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown are going to be coming off rookie contracts, those guys are going to be getting paid a lot of money, man. And so if we're looking at near max for all these young guys with all this potential, yeah, they're going to have to do some jumping jacks to find a way to fit their cap, man. So if they are going to make any moves, you're right. It's going to have to happen either this year or early next year. And Gordon Hayward is the most paid player on the team. How is Kyrie still getting paid $18 million a year? Kyrie, man.
Because his contract hasn't expired.
He needs $40 million.
CBA.
He needs $40 million, man.
But that's another problem as well, because Kyrie's contract is going to expire as well, so you got to pay him, Brown, Tatum, Marcus Smart, and then you're still going to have Al Horford either 1 year left on the books or probably around the time he's going to come off the books, all that stuff is going to happen, and then you still have Hayward. Like, financially speaking, the team is great talent-wise, but financially speaking, there's just not enough wiggle room.
I think they do, because they have enough to work out. They have enough good picks and young guys like Terry Rozier, even Shane Larkin. Actually, no, he's going to be gone after this year. But they have enough young guys they can move if they want. Marcus Morris proved himself to be incredibly valuable. At $5 million a year, he's a bargain for any team that wants him.
But eventually, he's not going to... Oh, okay, you're talking about trading.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I'm saying, like, you could always tag one of those bargain players with the pick and Gordon Hayward for another player on a different team. Do you know how valuable the picks that the Celtics have are?
The Kings pick is an unprotected Kings pick. So next year's unprotected.
So a good pick. All right, nice.
So that's pretty. I'm gonna say it's pretty valuable. But I mean, but in general, at this point, we are kind of like nitpicking what the Sixers did this year. I mean, not Sixers on even the Sixers as well. But what the Celtics did this year was probably the most impressive thing I've seen in a very long time, at least since
is it more impressive than the Mavericks winning?
That's where I would maybe have to stop and suggest that maybe it's not. But I mean, even that Mavericks team still had veterans, still had Dirk. I mean, this is a team that's literally led by, and this is no knock on any of these players, but you know, the great Al Horford, one all NBA team, a few all star selections, but never viewed as being the best player on the team that can make it to the conference finals and push LeBron to a game 7. Jaylen Brown, second year player. Jason Tatum, a rookie. Marcus Morris was bouncing around the NBA before he got on his team. Marcus Smart is a bench player. And Terry Rozier was assigned to 6 G League teams. Jeez. Before he finally made the cut to make this roster. So this is not like some team that has players that really should have made it this far, which is why it's extremely impressive. And again, Brad Stevens, because I don't want to leave him out, Brad Stevens was great this entire year.
Yeah, I feel like Brad Stevens needs a pay raise. They should find a way to renegotiate that contract. Man, just think about it. They could sell off a lot of these players for a lot more than they're probably worth on the free market, just because they're playing in a system that's so fantastic. That is probably inflated.
Like they did with Kyrie
and Jay Crowder. Yep, all those players, right?
Yep.
Wait, Kyrie. They just got Kyrie. You saying Kyrie's a system guy?
No, what I'm saying is how they got Kyrie with Jay Crowder and Isaiah Thomas. And Jay Crowder and Isaiah Thomas may not be as good as, you know, as people are saying.
Yeah, just like that.
But they only looked that good because of that system. Yep. You know, that definitely can happen as well.
So if you're the Cavaliers, you should almost at this point know that your team is losing to the Warriors. Interestingly enough, wait, do you have anything you want to say about the Cavaliers before we move on to the Warriors?
I know you don't like to do this, but I mean, this is just further proof and evidence.
Are you bringing up the Hall of Fame?
No,
comparing him to Michael Jordan.
This is further, not even comparing, I'm just saying he's the second greatest player of all time. And I don't. I would go as far as saying even with Michael Jordan, whoever you want to say, I really don't know that many players in NBA history, if any, that would have been able to do what he's been able to do this postseason run at the age that he's at on that team with the amount of miles that he has on his body. It's remarkable. 15 years in, 8 straight finals appearances. The other 7 to me are not that impressive, but this
one. He played the entire game 7. He played 48 minutes.
Yeah. And played 46 minutes in game 6.
That's not healthy. That's why Kobe got injured. Kobe tried doing that.
and it's played up until the game 7. He's played over 50,000 minutes, career minutes.
That's crazy.
That's crazy.
Yeah, unreal. They had his over-under at 38 points, or was it 36 points? And I was like, God damn, imagine how great you have to be where people just are expecting you to get at least 38 points. Like, that is crazy. And I put out this tweet the second the second after game 6 was over. I'm like, yo, I don't know about y'all, but here's what I know. LeBron doesn't lose game 7. So Celtics got off to a hot start, but I knew the Cavs were going to find a way and slowly clawed their way back and found a way to secure the W. You know what I'm tired of, Lo? Every time LeBron does something like fantastic, like he'll do an insane dunk or incredible shooting, contested shot, or and one with insane strength, I hop on Twitter and here I am just thinking to myself, what a fantastic player. And here I'm just celebrating the player, the individual player. And on Twitter, it's like, see, that's why he's better than Michael Jordan. Do you see that? Michael Jordan could never do that. And I'm like, man, what is wrong with these people? These LeBron fans, Lo, they're victims. They always victimize themselves. I keep seeing LeBron fans talk about how everybody's always hating on LeBron, and then how he's better than. But every time I'm looking, is the LeBron fans being toxic? Let's just appreciate how fantastic of a run this has been for the Cavaliers. And who knows? Maybe they'll find a way to pull one out. You know, but
no,
they won't. Not, but you know, assuming no injuries, they definitely will not. But man, wow, you're right, Lo. I don't know how he can't be number 2 after this year. Oh, I'd have to come up with a list, of course, to verify that. But
Wow!
Of course, the list would come first. But yeah.
Wow, agent, that's crazy.
So let's talk about the Golden State Warriors versus the Houston Rockets. Lo, I'm not feeling this Golden State team at all. They're not as good as they were last year or the year before. They're having these long dry runs offensively, which is odd. And now, granted, Klay was in foul trouble a lot of Game 7, and so maybe they didn't have Klay, but you have Stephen Curry and Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant, who's been struggling throughout the series, it's almost baffled me how you can have so much talent, and still, even though you've been playing great offense the last few years, just automatically crumble for extended periods of time. There was moments where I didn't think the Warriors were going to win the game, and I had no doubt the Warriors were going to win before this series began. So before we even get into anything, let me just say this. The Houston Rockets defensively were fantastic. And I never thought I would say that. They were a horrible team in the past. This year, they were they were good. They were fantastic in these playoffs. To hold that team to, there was times where like it was halftime and like they had like low 40s in points. And I'm like, wow, that is impressive, man. And they don't even have a lot of great defenders on that team. Granted, they weren't playing guys like Ryan Anderson much throughout the course of the playoffs, who's offensive oriented and isn't that great on defense. But man, I really thought the Rockets were going to come away with it after the first half, Lo. I went to sleep because halftime took forever, and then I wake up and the Warriors already won with like 2 minutes left. I was incredibly pissed off. But that would have been maybe the only chance for the Cavaliers to win the finals. What's your takeaway, man? What's happening with this Golden State-Houston Rockets series?
Like you said, the Rockets, what they did defensively is what really stood out to me. There were just moments where I felt like P.J. Tucker just wanted it more than anybody else on the floor. The way he was able to rebound, I think it was one game where he grabbed like 6 or 8 offensive boards. It was ridiculous. And for someone that size, and there was moments where he would just out-rebound Kevin Durant, he was vastly impressive. And so it's interesting because I don't want to necessarily live off of a what if, but it is interesting to think if Chris Paul was healthy, how they would have finished off their series.
Probably would want, to be honest.
Because like you said, though, there was moments in both game and game six where they had a lead that was pretty sizable, and I think a huge thing that killed the Rockets, which ironically is what made the Rockets, which was their three-point shooting, when you get to a point where you're shooting 0 for 27, where you're missing 27 consecutive three-pointers in a two-quarter stretch in the middle of the second quarter to the middle of the fourth quarter, when you get to that stretch of basketball, the fact that really no one made the decision to stop shooting threes and just start getting to the rim and drawing fouls and kind of disrupt the flow of the Warriors, while also the Warriors are going on that run as well, that's the part where Chris Paul kind of steps in. And even though I know the analytic community doesn't like it, but you got to find a way to just get some shots. And even if that means taking mid-range jumpers, that's what you have to do. And so part of me wants to, I'm applauding them because no one expecting them to get this far. And I'm also applauding them because of the defensive intensity. However, I think the thing that made them is the thing that was a demise.
I don't think so.
And it's amazing to me.
I sincerely believe that their ridiculous offense they run, which in so many ways, especially when they're not hitting shots, is frustrating, actually works. And it's been working the entire series. And if Chris Paul was still there, because remember, there was games where literally the whole team was playing bad and it was Chris Paul hitting all these ridiculous shots, keeping... There was a timeout low, I believe it was in game five, where Chris Paul just had everything on lock. Coach wasn't saying nothing. James Harden was sitting down with the towel, and it was Chris Paul running shit. And so to have him not there, almost to like transform as a team leader, I think was massive. But after this year, we just saw a team that was fantastic on offense but horrible on defense fix up their defense and prove to us that their ridiculous offense works. The same way when the Warriors first won the NBA Finals, we were super clear at that point that it's not teams that shoot a high frequency of three-point shots can still be successful. And so I think it's just about breaking the boundary and quote-unquote getting over the hump. And although they didn't win, I'm convinced now that next year they're going to come back really strong, man. And, you know, just if KD wasn't on that team or like with that much talent just to be able to keep up, I'm impressed. Now, I am a little disappointed in the Rockets for performing so horribly in that last game offensively. Let me just talk to you about some of the three-point numbers for this team, because it was downright pathetic. Trevor Ariza was 0 for 9 from 3. P.J. Tucker had the greatest percentage on the team, 2 for 5. Eric Gordon was 2 for 12. James Harden was 2 for 13. Gerald Green was 1 for 4. Joe Johnson was 0 for 1. So the whole team was chucking up bricks. If I'm not mistaken, though, they missed 27 threes in a row at one point.
Yeah, that's what I just said. Yeah, 27
that's crazy.
Threes.
I saw that number so many times on Twitter, and I could not believe it. Like, we just seen the Celtics put up this pathetic offensive... I don't know what they were doing. They're just breaking everything. And here we go. Houston Rockets trying to one-up them with probably the most brutal performance I've seen offensively in a while. Unfortunately, man, I think Chris Paul would have changed that. I think he would have.
But let me say this about the whole like shooting threes thing, and this is why I disagree. Because in game four and in game five, they were able to win even as they shot poorly from behind the arc. And game four, they held the Golden State Warriors only 92 points, which is amazing. And they only had to score 95 points. P.J. Tucker 0 for 2 from behind the arc. James Harden, 3 for 12 from behind the arc. Eric Gordon, 1 for 8 from behind the arc. Gerald Green, 1 for 4 from behind the arc. And as a team, they shot 31.6% from behind the arc. And then in game 5, they shot 30% man. From behind the arc. And in game 5, this man James Harden shot 0 for 11 from behind the arc.
My goodness.
And they still won. And so I understand what you're saying about, you know, you the 3-point, and I get the whole spacing, I get the whole mathematics that comes behind it as well. But there are just times where they didn't have to keep shooting threes. There's times where they could have just went inside the lane and just find easy baskets. But when you're playing that level of defense, that deep into the playoffs, that level of fatigue will eventually catch up with you, and you're going to eventually underperform, yeah. Especially when you're asking players like PJ Tucker and Trevor Ariza to guard some of the greatest shooters the league has ever seen on the other side of the floor. But, and so with me saying that as well, it's hard for me, and I know people that want me to answer this as well. It's really hard for me to criticize or even look at James Harden in a negative light, despite the fact that I know for a fact that he consistently does this. James Harden finished this series shooting 41% from the field and 24% from behind the arc. He scored around 29 points, but 6 assists, but turned the ball over basically five times. And so it's hard for me because I understand the load that he has to carry offensively. But on the flip side of things, there are just so many times where Harden takes shots where it's just like, that's not a good shot. Like, even if you want to go with the analytics of threes are better than twos, a contested three, a heavily contested three, as you're trying to draw a foul and you don't get the foul, that's not better than an open two just because it's a three. Shots like that is what makes Harden so frustrating to watch because he does it so consistently, and those end up being wasted possessions. And so it's hard. It is easy for me to look at D'Antoni and the way that he plays and why I think a lot of his teammates or a lot of his players, they underperform from behind the arc, despite the fact that that wasn't a theme throughout the regular season. But James Harden does this almost every single year. And I don't know if it's because he's not in physical shape. I don't know if it's because he has too much of load offensively, though.
I can't think of a reason why.
But I mean, but even Chris Paul was, even when Chris Paul was playing with him in the first five games, it's not like he was shooting that great either. Because again, in game five, he shot 0 for 11 from behind the arc. So I don't know what it is. And I don't know why I'm necessarily trying to find an excuse.
I think it's just because it's predictable, maybe Harden, right?
Just doesn't perform.
Like, you drive.
Yeah, he's very predictable.
You might do
a
pick and roll, catch Capella on the oop. If not, if they, for whatever reason, collapse, like Golden State was doing a lot in Game 7, then you just find it, kick it to the corner, and Trevor Ariza will go 0 for 9 from 3 over there. Or you might catch P.J. Tucker, and on a good day, he'll shoot 2 for 5. Like, I just think their offense is so predictable. It's almost like they're allergic to mid-range shots. Like, we see players like Sean Livingston lives for mid-range. KD lives for mid-range. Even though he's a great three-point... Man, you got me fucked up, Lo. My phone is ringing.
Face.
You see this shit? I can't even do a podcast at 1 a.m., Lo, without getting interrupted. That is crazy, bro.
Oh, my God.
That is crazy.
Hey, I'll say this while he answered his phone real quick. With the Harden being predictable thing, again, I agree with you. And I think he should mix it up way more. And I think that's the part of LeBron's game and Chris Paul's game that is so valuable, that at the end of games, they're able to have some level of time management that works in their favor heavily. And getting to the free throw line, making mid-range jumpers, even though analytically it may not be the best shot, it still works out for them. But in Game 7... when Klay Thompson picks up 3 fouls in the first quarter, how you cannot capitalize that is beyond me.
Yeah.
I don't know how you cannot capitalize. Like, that's a perfect example of Game 7 at home. You have a massive advantage because their starting guard that will be defending you just picked up 3 quick fouls. And if I'm not mistaken, 2 of the quick fouls, They were picked up on Harden. Like, Harden was the reason why he picked them up. And the fact that he still was not able to capitalize in game seven, even with that type of advantage.
But, like, even though Klay had 3 fouls, he convinced Steve Kerr to put him on most of the second quarter. Imagine if you pick up 4 fouls in the second quarter and you're like, you're Klay Thompson. He was like, I don't know what the numbers are, but just from watching the games, he was been the best shooter on the court that series. Man, Lo, a thought crossed my mind when I was watching the series. You gotta tell me if I'm crazy. I was seeing Klay Thompson knock down everything, and I just thought to myself for a second, I don't know if I believed it or not, I just thought it though. Is Klay Thompson
he's the second best
shooting
guard?
Shooter than Curry? What is happening? We've seen, I think Curry, been having his injury issues, and we don't know how. They'll never make the excuse, they'll never come out and say it. But the way I seen Klay shooting coming off these screens, man, I was thinking to myself,
no.
You might have to call the plays for Klay Thompson the rest of the series, man, the way he's shooting.
Stop.
I don't know if I believed it. Stop. It just crossed my mind, though. I'm just saying, man.
You didn't watch that third quarter.
No, I watched it back, yeah.
That third quarter was monstrous for Curry.
Yeah.
Monstrous. Like, that third quarter definitely kind of set the tone and reevaluated any second thoughts that anybody had about Curry and where he ranked. So, I can't say that either. But, I mean, Klay Thompson is the second greatest shooter of all time. Because, the way that he just comes off screens or he's knocking down three-pointers, some of them are contested. Like, yeah, I think... And he shows up, too. That's the part that, is amazing to me, that he's a perfect 3-and-D guy that shows up. And I don't know how many players can say that they're able to do that, let alone teams even say they have players who be able to do that, especially at the clip in which Klay is able to do so when it comes to shooting threes. I agree with what you're saying, but it's just that after that first quarter, I don't know how Harden continued to struggle with Klay Thompson spending time on the bench. I just don't. I don't see how that's possible.
They were collapsing on him, and he was kicking it out a lot. They were double teaming Harden every time he drove, and they were relying on good rotations.
But in the first half, let me double. I'm about to look at it right now. In the first half, I don't think Klay played that many minutes because of the fouls.
He did.
He played 15 minutes in the first half.
No, I know, but considering he got three fouls in 5 minutes of playing, he played with three fouls for a long time.
But even in the first half, as Harden played more minutes because Klay Thompson
wasn't defending him though. Dealing with it. When he came back with his third foul, I think they put.
But that still is further proof. The fact that they couldn't put Klay Thompson on Harden, that should mean that it should make it easier for Harden. Harden finished the first half shooting 5 for 15 from the field, 2 for 8 from behind.
What do you do if you're D'Antoni? He has a green light to shoot. You don't want to.
You have to mix it up. That's what I'm getting at. I don't know if I'm blaming Harden because this isn't the first time, and that's the reason why I'm looking at Harden kind of suspiciously. But then on the flip side, I know that's how D'Antoni is coaching. I know D'Antoni is just giving them this outrageously false confidence to just keep shooting threes, even though that's not really working. And so I don't necessarily know who should receive more blame in those decisions that were being made. Also, on another note, if I'm not mistaken, D'Antoni finished that game with 4 timeouts that he never used, despite the fact that they were running. They were running out of juice, and they were missing a whole bunch of threes, and the Warriors were going on a ridiculous run, and he never called a timeout during the third quarter, and if he did, it was once.
That you shouldn't lose that game. I know you didn't have Chris Paul, but even without Chris Paul, you're at home. You fought all year to get this advantage, to play this Game 7 at your home court. I know Chris Paul wasn't playing, man, but damn. I'm disappointed in D'Antoni. I'm disappointed in Harden. But at the same time, I think I'm not angry at them. I'm more hopeful that next year they'll be back. And hopefully, depending on the Capella situation, they'll be better. They'll come back better. I don't know why. Remember when they hacked him in the first quarter? I was thinking, maybe you should. They slowed the whole pace down when they began to hack Capella. I was in my mind, I'm thinking, just continue to hack. It's working. Whether he misses free
throws. I low-key thought about that, too.
I don't know why he stopped doing it. Almost like he felt bad that the crowd was going to be disappointed. Who cares? You want to make it to the NBA Finals. It was... I don't know. Maybe he didn't want some of his guys to get too many fouls. But give Sean Livingston the fouls. There's so many options, man. I don't know. I felt like it was a good strategy.
But see... Here's another thing, too, I want to say about that, about them getting this close. That's the part that's so interesting about it, is that, and that's the reason why I'm kind of obsessed to try to figure out what exactly they need to do, because even with them having, unlucky things happen to them with Chris Paul getting hurt and then them being massively flawed down the stretch in both game 6 and 7, and even if you want to say they were unlucky with them missing the three-pointers 27 in a row, and it's even some people were saying that the refs were in heavily favored for the Warriors. Even with all of that against them, they still push it to a 7-game series. And in the halftime in game 7, they were up by 11. So it's not like it was that irrational for them to be in that game, and it's in it, and eventually win that series. And so the reason why I'm harping on trying to figure out why they lost it is because if they make that one tweak, it could legit just be one tweak and they could potentially beat them.
I don't think it's a tweak. Now again, I think it's plenty of issues that maybe plenty of things they can improve on. I don't think it's just one thing, man.
I think a lot of it just has to do with D'Antoni. And I'm not trying to exclude or leave out what Harden did, because again, Harden played poorly again, but I just don't know how you can expect somebody to keep up that level of intensity. And this is beyond Harden. This is like the entire team. When D'Antoni is running a 7-man rotation, expecting them to play defense at an elite level, and then go on the other end and just chuck up threes.
That might have been it. I think it might have been fatigue. Like, yeah, 7-man rotation. Guys was playing serious minutes, man. Right?
But that's again, that's D'Antoni and how you end the game with 4 timeouts. Like, stuff like that just doesn't... It doesn't make any sense to me. I just don't get that.
There was a time, I don't know if you booked it, where they had an official's timeout, played some commercials, they got back into the game, and immediately another timeout was called by the Warriors.
Called another timeout.
And I was how you rest your players, man. Somebody was obviously tired on Golden State. That's why they did that. If your guys are tired, man, you're playing them serious minutes, just use the timeouts. I mean, I know it rests the other team too, but damn, man. If your team is missing 27 straight threes, they ought to get some rest. That might be the solution.
I don't know, but I after all of that, I do want to just give props to the Rockets, because I feel like some of those players, like I said, PJ Tucker, even though Trevor Ariza missed a lot of his shots, and you know it is what it is, but still Trevor Ariza on the defensive end. I think Eric Gordon had moments on the offensive end. I think Chris Paul, it's crazy. Chris Paul might have proven that he's still one of the top 10 players in the NBA, but for like people like Chris Paul and LeBron 10. To be.
You might be,
but I mean, or bare minimum top 15.
Yeah, okay, that might be an argument.
For people like Chris Paul and LeBron to be in the NBA 13 to 15 years and them still being able to play at that level is ridiculous. Yep, it is. It's ridiculous. Yeah.
On that note, what else? I don't think there's anything else that happened in the NBA.
No, that's about it, because
the finals. Yeah. Oh, are you excited, Lo? Or are you?
I'm not excited. It's the same thing.
I saw King of the Fourth Quarter tweet. Part of me, he was like, "How could you not be excited about the finals where we could see LeBron take on the best?" And I was like, "What do you mean, man? We just seen this as a matchup like 3 years in a row, man. How could you still be excited about it? Like, I get the prospect that LeBron could overcome and crazy come, but man, it'd be nice to see a different team in the finals for once." It's kind of boring seeing the same old team. Maybe for us, for the casual fans, they probably love it. You know, the guys that just watch like a few games a year, then show up in the finals to be the biggest LeBron fanboys or the biggest Steph Curry fanboys. Interestingly enough,
but see that's the problem, and that's the reason why I don't necessarily know it's the best thing that they keep going to the finals, because you're almost building an NBA that's dependent on LeBron. And I don't think that may work, because it's only a few more years that LeBron is going to be in the NBA. And if you don't mix it up, even though people love to act like there's always been no to little parity in the NBA, it's never been to this extreme. It's literally never been to this extreme.
You tell me we haven't seen the same matchup 4 times in a row with 30 different teams?
Four years in a row. It is literally never been this extreme. And so when people talk about, and again, I understand what they're saying as well, but when people refer to about how there's always been super teams or there's always been little to no parity, that's not correct. Even though Kobe went to the finals 3 consecutive years in 2008, 9, and 10, people did not know in the beginning of the season that Kobe was going to make the finals all 3 of those years. They did not know that. They did not know in the beginning of the season that was going to happen. Even though Duncan and the Spurs went on to go to 6 finals and won 5 championships, it may have been one season where they were heavily favored to make the finals. Outside of that, at most, I know for a fact three, possibly four of those finals appearances that they made, people did not know in the beginning of the season that they were going to make it. When Dallas made it to the finals both of the years, people did not know they were going to make it, especially when it comes to the Pistons making it and et cetera, et cetera. Like, this idea that it's always been this way, that is completely false. That is completely false. People got to stop with that. That's a false narrative.
Indeed it is. On that note, Lo, we should end the pod here. We haven't done a highlight player in a minute, man. Lo, what's your highlight player?
I mean, shit, I got a few people, but I'm going to give it to PJ Tucker, because like I said before, the way he was playing, I got to find that number and the rebounds he had. It was one game where he had like, I think he had like 8 offensive boards. It was ridiculous. Yeah, like, but PJ Tucker really wanting it, going after it, giving it his all. And when you're asking, when you're looking for a player like PJ Tucker in today's league, which is pretty valuable, crazy enough, you really can't ask more out of a player such as PJ Tucker. But PJ Tucker was out there giving it his all, playing, in my opinion, more than what he had to do. It was game 7. He had 8 offensive rebounds. 8.
He was boxing folks out, man. Just chucking folks.
Boxing people out.
Yeah. I'm going to give mine to my guy Marcus Smart and also Al Horford. Both of those guys have been incredibly impressive throughout the playoffs. And I don't even know. They both did their own thing. Marcus Smart defensively, fantastic. Maybe just Al Horford. I used to mock Al Horford because people pegged him as this transformational player that's going to bring the Celtics to the finals. Al Horford's going to be the one. And so they built up all these expectations. But what do we know? Al Horford has been a great leader for the team. And honestly, man, they wouldn't be anywhere near where they are right now without him, especially with Hayward and Kyrie out. So those are my 2 highlight players.
Facto.
On that note, Lo, that'll be it for the Off Top Podcast, otherwise known as the Brian Colangelo is a fucking idiot. Was that the name of the podcast? I think it was.
Yeah.
And we'll catch you guys on the next one, where hopefully I won't be sick. Peace! Peace!
You're so corny. Oh, what we should have said, this man Pusha T bodied Drake.
You think so? Yeah. I don't think he got bodied. I think it was good, though. It was nice.
Cut it out. Well, cut it out. Cut it out.
Though, right? We knew because he talked about it in More Life. There was rumors all early last year that he had a kid. I don't think he got bodied.